the minor prophets, some that weren't covered last quarter, and we're in Hosea this morning. We'll be in Hosea chapter 5 after a brief review here in a minute. I will warn you that the air conditioning is back in, is out in the back classrooms this morning, so we may be invaded by a bunch of little Indians a little earlier than we might think that they should be here. So I'm not sure how long we'll go, but we'll try for the whole 40 minutes. We'll see how far we go. Again, thanks for being here for our Bible study this morning. We've been talking about Hosea. His name means salvation, but the message that he preached was not a message of salvation for the northern kingdom of Israel. He appears to be from Israel, the northern kingdom, at least that's what it seems to be the case. And his message to them, to the people inspired by God, was especially meaningful because he was personally called to experience what God was experiencing with his unfaithful wife, Israel. Hosea was called upon to marry a woman of harlotry and experience all of the trials and tribulations of that. And that's what God had gone through with his people, Israel. When we think about the theme of the book, I think it's really set out in the second verse of the book when it says that the Lord began to speak to Hosea. The Lord said to Hosea, "Go take yourself a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry, for the land has committed great harlotry by departing from the Lord." Such a sad and emotional situation, really. But God's relentless love for Israel is seen throughout the book, despite her unfaithfulness, despite all of the wickedness that she's involved in. He loves her. He loves her forever. And he would do anything for her to bring her back to a covenant relationship with him. But she refuses, and so she must be punished. Here's our little outline of the book as we're following through. God's love and Israel's adultery is illustrated by Hosea's experience with the wife of harlotry. That's the first three chapters that we've already covered. And then in the core of the book of Hosea, you have several chapters that are just discourses on adulterous Israel and her faithful God. And we'll be looking this morning, starting in chapter 5 in just a minute. There is hope for Israel's restoration in the future, at least a spiritual restoration in the Messianic kingdom. And we'll see that when we get to the end of the book. So in chapter 4, what we'd seen was that in Israel, there's no truth, there's no mercy or knowledge of God at all. And she's charged with that. The people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. They not only do they not know the will of God, the law of God, they don't know God. They don't understand his character. They don't understand what he's expecting of them as their covenant partner. And they just don't understand him at all. They've lost sight of all of that because of their materialism, their oppression of others, and particularly their idolatry. So all of that is brought up. The spirit of harlotry prevailed throughout the land, not just literal harlotry, which was there, literal adultery, which was there, but spiritual adultery. So many of the idolatrous cults of the Canaanites that these people were engaged in involved literal harlotry. You would commit sexual immorality with a ritual harlot as you engaged in these religions. But it was far beyond that. That was just a metaphor for the fact that they had left the God that was faithful to them to follow lovers, as Hosea puts it, that were entirely unconcerned about the well-being of Israel and did not love her at all. So Judah is warned not to offend like Israel has. We see that repeatedly, actually, as we go through this. The message is to Israel. Hosea is prophesying 750-ish BC, a little bit later than that. And the destruction of Israel is coming up in 722. But there's a warning throughout to Judah. This is what's going to happen to you if you don't straighten up. We see that repeatedly throughout the book. So that brings us to chapter 5. And then this is material that we haven't covered so far. Priests and kings would be judged for ensnaring souls and for their insolent pride. Hear this, O priests. Take heed, O house of Israel. Give ear, O house of the king, for yours is the judgment because you have been a snare to Mizpah and a net spread on Tabor. These sites in the northern kingdom, representative of the nation as a whole. And the leaders, the priests and the rulers, they had been the ones to ensnare the people with idolatry, with unfaithfulness, with a love of luxury, with all that's wrong in the northern kingdom. The Lord is fully aware of the harlotry of Israel. The revolters are deeply involved in slaughter, though I rebuke them all. I know Ephraim, and Israel is not hidden from me. For now, Ephraim, you commit harlotry, and Israel is defiled. We know, as we have before, that Ephraim, of course, is part of the northern kingdom. The tribe became so large and so influential, centered as it was in the upper hill country of the promised land, that sometimes the whole northern kingdom is referred to just as Ephraim. Sometimes that's sort of split out as here's this big tribe that's so influential, and then you have the rest of the nation as well. But really the terms are used synonymously by Hosea, and so it's good to remember that. That can be a little confusing when you're going through, but really they're pretty much used synonymously. Verse 4, they do not direct their deeds toward turning to their God, for the spirit of harlotry is in their midst. They do not know the Lord. This phrase, the spirit of harlotry, we've noticed it before a couple of times in Hosea already. It really depicts the whole gamut of their unfaithfulness, as I've already mentioned, the idolatry, the sexual immorality, the luxury in which they lived, and credit it to the idols and used it to glorify the idols instead of God. All of that is the spirit of harlotry, as has been defined. And so the pride of Israel testifies to his face. Therefore, Israel and Ephraim stumble in their iniquity. Judah also stumbles with them. Judah is, again, not left out entirely of this message. There is a warning that's sort of tangent to the main message, but throughout you have this warning to Israel as well. They are going to seek the Lord, but not find him. With their flocks and herds, they shall go to seek the Lord, but they will not find him because he has withdrawn himself from them. God loved these people. And yet, as we've seen already and we'll see again, the love that he had for them was not a love of condoning their unfaithfulness. It's not that at all. He's a holy God. He's a jealous God. And his love required that he not support them in their wicked ways, that he separate himself from them for a time. There's a pretty good lesson on tough love for us there as well, isn't there? As we love friends and family deeply, who nonetheless have forsaken the Lord's ways, we can't condone that. We can't encourage that in any way. And as painful as it is for us to say to loved ones, you know, I just can't support you in that. I can't encourage you in that. We may have to withdraw fellowship from someone, family, friends, members of the Lord's church. But that's what love does. If we really care about people, and God truly cared about these people, he wasn't going to just go along with the things that they were doing. He says they have dealt treacherously with the Lord. They have begotten pagan children. Now a new moon shall devour them and their heritage. They had so thoroughly been involved in the spirit of harlotry that now the children themselves were pagan. The entire family of Israel was given over to heathen pursuits and to idolatry. Sudden destruction would come upon them. A new moon would devour them, is what he says. Blow the ram's horn in Gibeah, the trumpet in Ramah. Cry aloud at Beth-Aven. Look behind you, O Benjamin. Ephraim shall be desolate in the day of rebuke among the tribes of Israel. I will make known what is sure. So the destruction that's coming is going to be, and was, as history would record, fairly sudden, pretty overwhelming, nothing they could do about it. Assyria, as we're going to see in a couple of chapters on, is going to swoop down like an eagle and just pluck them up, and that's going to be the end of it. the idea of a new moon. In other words, a short period of time, a month's time, is all it's going to take for. He's not saying it's going to happen in a month from now, but he's saying it's going to happen swiftly when it does happen. They're going to be desolate, and that will be known to all. So again, just in broad terms, the message is what it's been. A lot of this is sort of review to this point in the book of Hosea. But the rulers of Judah are like those who remove an ancient landmark. Listen to this. The princes of Judah are like those who remove a landmark. I will pour out my wrath on them like water. Ephraim is oppressed and broken in judgment because he willingly walked by human precept. Therefore, I will be to Ephraim like a moth and to the house of Judah like rottenness. Some very powerful metaphors are being used here to describe the sin of Ephraim and Israel and God's judgment upon them. They'd removed the ancient landmark. What's the significance of that? Ancient landmarks, what were they for? All right, maintain distinction between the tribes and even between maybe parcels of land that the various families owned within those allotments, right? So your landmarks would be your boundary markers. So if you think about that, on your property, you probably have, it's maybe even written in the deed to your land or the title work, some of the boundary markers where a surveyor put a stake, or there's this big pole or something that, you know, marks sort of where the boundary is. And just think about going along and you're pulling up those boundary markers because you're going to take somebody else's land, or you're not going to regard what the boundaries are supposed to be. There's a literal application of this. And back in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse 14, the law had said, do not remove your neighbor's landmark, which the men of old have set. The idea would be that you're not respecting the boundary of the land there, and maybe you're just going to take some of it for yourself. In your inheritance, which you will inherit in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. In Deuteronomy 27:17, cursed is the one who moves his neighbor's landmark. So there's a literal, probably, from what we've learned in Israel, that kind of stuff was going on. People had no regard for law, no regard for boundaries. And whether it's taking somebody else's land just by saying, no, that's not your property, that's not your property line here, we'll just remove that landmark. Whether they're literally doing that, or the point might further be that they have no respect for the boundaries of God. Here, God has set boundaries. Oh, we don't care about that, you know. Maybe that's what it's supposed to be, but we'll just remove that and do what we want to do. That's the attitude. That's the mindset. He says that Ephraim has oppressed and broken in judgment. He willingly walked by human precept. That reminds me more than just a little bit of Jesus' condemnation of the Pharisees in Matthew 15. Their tradition of giving the money to the temple displaced God's law to honor your father and mother. So if they wanted to give money to the temple, even if they had parents who were destitute, they followed the tradition rather than God's law. They walked by human precept rather than the law of God. And Jesus says, they draw near to me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain they worship me, teaching as their doctrines the precepts of men. Exactly the same problem. What had been done in the northern kingdom back to the time of Jeroboam? Jeroboam set up the calves at Dan and Bethel, developed this whole system of worship, of religion, that he said was to worship the God of Israel, that he said was worship to Jehovah, but it was not. It was human precept. Was God ever happy with that? No, he never accepted that. And yet that's what they had done. He willingly walked by human precept, and he's going to be punished for that. He says, I will be to Ephraim like a moth. Anybody here ever had a moth get in your closet and do some work there? you get out your favorite shirt or jacket or whatever, and all of a sudden you can see through that thing because it's just been worked on by a moth. And slowly and almost imperceptibly, decay and destruction take place. And Israel was sliding downhill, and as we'll see in a minute, did not realize it. The house of Judah also like rottenness. Things rot slowly, but they rot sure enough. And that's what has been happening in Israel and Judah because they've not paid attention to the law of God and they followed their own ways. If that's not a condemnation of modern religion, I don't know what would be. When they saw they were decaying, they reached out to foreign powers instead of to God. Look what it says in verse 13. Verse 12, yeah, it'll be like a moth and rottenness. And then verse 13, Ephraim saw his wickedness and Judah saw his wound. Then Ephraim went to Assyria, not turning back to God, but pleading with the very ones who are going to be their destroyers and captors. Ephraim went to Assyria, sent to King Jareb, metaphorically, one of the kings of a foreign nation. He cannot cure you, nor heal your wound. For I will be like a lion to Ephraim, and a young lion to the house of Judah. I will tear them and go away. I will take them away, and no one will rescue. I will return again to my place till they acknowledge their offense. Then they will seek my face in their affliction. They will earnestly seek me. God is saying, what's the point of a young lion? Young lions, I can tell you from observation personally, are not as powerful as the big old lions. But they are, in a way, more dangerous because they're more aggressive. They're less predictable in their behavior. Like the young lions, coming after you. That's sort of the metaphor that's being used. But God, like a lion, is just going to rip them, into shreds until they try to seek his face, until they realize their need for him. And as has already been said in Hosea and will be said again, they're going to wish they could go to God in those days of captivity. Israel will not be able to find him. And Judah only after a long time. That's the message of the prophets. Thoughts or comments or questions maybe on chapter 5? Something anybody like to add? The first three verses of chapter 6, I'll just say, give commentators no end of grief because it's not clear who's talking or in what context it is. Is it to be taken, chapter 6 in the first few verses, three verses, as these are words that Israel and Judah might speak when they try to seek the Lord? Or is it to be put in the mouth of Hosea to encourage Israel and Judah to seek the Lord? I kind of take the latter, but either one of those could be what's being said here. Let me just read these verses to you and you can see what maybe you think about it. Come and let us return to the Lord, for he is torn, but he will heal us. He is stricken, but he will bind us up. After 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will raise us up that we may live in his sight. Let us know. Let us pursue the knowledge of the Lord. His going forth is established as the morning. He will come to us like the rain, like the latter and former rain to the earth. I'd set this up a second ago as if it's sort of a choice between maybe this is what Israel is saying when it's gone into captivity after the Lord has shredded it. And I think that there's some validity to that, but also something that Hosea is trying to encourage Israel to say. It's not necessarily the case that we have to choose between the two of those. Could be both. One of these places where it would really fit either way and may actually be intended to fit either way. God, I believe, though, through Hosea, is appealing to Israel to return on the basis that he's going to heal and revive her. Anybody notice something that caught your eye there that made you think, well, this could be a reference to something in the New Testament? What do you see? Yeah, the third day raise that jumps out at you, doesn't it? The third day raise him up. And so the reference there is probably mainly the concept like Ezekiel uses in the Valley of Dry Bones. Remember that from Ezekiel chapter 37, that as a nation, Israel is going to be as if it were dead. Ezekiel is prophesying not to Israel, but to Judah later on. Judah's in captivity. Ezekiel's part of that captivity. The nation is as good as dead. And God takes him to see this valley of dry bones. They're very dry. You know, there's no life at all left in them. And God asks him, can these bones live? And Ezekiel says, well, you know if they can live. And God says, I'm going to make them live. I'm going to breathe life back into them. And Ezekiel watches as, you know, the skeletons come to life and flesh and sinew and muscle is put on them. And God breathes back into these skeletons the breath of life. And it all symbolizes a nation that appears to be wiped out and entirely dead coming back to life. That, I think, is what's being said about Israel as well. That the people will be given life, at least spiritual life, in a future time. Now, that I'm really sure is part of this message. But might it have something to do with the resurrection of Christ as well? And you can imagine commentators, scholars on this are all over the place as to how they perceive that. But I get to teach this class, and we're not all the scholars, and so they're not telling us. Here's a view I think that may have some validity. I believe there may be at least an oblique reference to the Messiah and his kingdom. Christ obviously was raised on the third day. His people, think about this, the people of Israel who later will be brought back into a covenant relationship, the people of Judah who later will be brought back into a covenant relationship, are in New Testament parlance raised together with Christ. Is that language found in the New Testament? That we are raised together with Christ? So when he comes back to life, after how many days? Three. If we're raised with him, symbolically, that's when we come back to life. Everybody follow that? So, you know, I'm kind of, as y'all have figured this out, if you listen to me teach about Old Testament or New Testament prophecy very long, I'm really, really convinced that many prophecies have broad application and often dual fulfillments. And we're almost unwise not to look for that. And so I think this is one of those where we are indeed probably meant to see the resurrection of Christ and the resurrection of his people. Scott? Yeah. Scott says, God knew one day we're going to make that connection when he inspired that to be written. I mean, let me just do a little survey. When I read that, and then when you went back and looked at it, how many people, when you saw raised the third day, thought of the resurrection of Christ without me mentioning it? That's about half the class, okay? So that, like Scott said, that's a sort of a natural thing that would pop into your head looking at it from our perspective. And so I think it's intentional. Jesus, in Luke 24 and verse 46, told his disciples, thus it is written, and thus it is necessary for the Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead the third day. How many prophecies are there in the Old Testament that Jesus Christ, the Messiah, would raise the third day? You know how many there are? If this isn't it, there aren't any. I think this is it. Okay? That raising the third day is not typically something that, other than you have the metaphoric thing with Jonah, you know, 3 days in the belly of the fish, which Jesus uses as well. But you have, as I said earlier, you have all of these statements. Ephesians 2 and verse 6, we're raised up together, made to sit together in the heavenly places with Christ. Romans 6, that just as Christ was raised from the dead through the glory of the Father, we also should walk in newness of life. When we participate in baptism, a death, burial, and resurrection, we participate in the resurrection of Christ. So I believe, again, that that has some pretty significant validity. As you read the next little section, getting back then to Hosea chapter 6, the text will say to us, Ephraim, what shall I do to you? What shall I do to you? Your faithfulness is like a morning cloud, like the early dew. It goes away. The early and the latter rain is mentioned in verse 3. God's going to provide that. But God, while He is faithful to provide the early and the latter rain, Ephraim is like a cloud that has no rain. That's the epitome of unfaithfulness. In fact, it's that symbolism is used. And you have again this contrast between the faithfulness of God and the unfaithfulness of these people. In Jude verse 12 in the New Testament, it speaks about those who are unfaithful, and Jude calls them clouds without water. I don't know how long it's been until last night since we've had rain. Anybody know it's been like a month, right? Since hardly anybody's had rain. Have we seen any clouds the last month? Well, a few, you know, and you might wake up in the morning, you see a cloud on the horizon, you think, wow, we might get some rain today. And that thing just kind of goes overhead and doesn't leave us with a drop of rain. It doesn't fulfill its promise. It doesn't do what we want it to do. And so Israel itself had been clouds without water, not fulfilling their purpose, not fulfilling what God had designed for them to do. What shall I do, O Judah? What should I do, Ephraim? For you are, your faithfulness is like a morning cloud. You look at that cloud in the morning, you think, wow, we might get some rain today. But no. Like the early dew, it goes away. Therefore, he says in verse 5, this is Hosea 6 and verse 5, therefore I have hewn them by the prophets, I have slain them by the words of my mouth. Your judgments are like light that goes forth. This is talking about, I think, the judgments of God there. God's judgment was just and firm in righteousness. It was light that was going out. And then in verse 6, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. Anybody heard that verse before? Matthew 9 and Matthew 12. God wanted of Israel an understanding of His love and His grace and reciprocation of that. He wanted mercy from them as He had given mercy to them. He wanted loving kindness from them as He had expressed loving kindness to them. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. Jesus does use that twice in the New Testament. You might look at Matthew chapter 9, which has been mentioned in verse 11. The Pharisees said to Jesus' disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? When Jesus heard that, He said to them, those who are well do not need a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous but sinners to repentance." The people of Hosea's day needed that lesson, that God was expecting them to show mercy and loving kindness to one another. We've already read lots of verses in Hosea and in Amos where these people were just oppressing one another, taking advantage of one another, removing the ancient landmarks, as we've already talked about this morning. They're doing all of that. No mercy. There's oppression, there's injustice. Jesus came to show mercy to those who needed mercy. God's people, from the time of Israel to the time of the Pharisees, had neglected that. Quotes this verse to teach that to the Pharisees. Yeah. So Brent's really making two points, and I repeat a little bit because not everybody can hear. But you know, the first thing is that the very thing that I was just mentioning, that the transgression, the oppression of these people, is what God's concerned about, and He mentions it in a following verse here in verse 9, right in this context. So they're not showing the mercy. But the other thing is, as Brent's saying, and I want to look at Matthew 12 for just a minute, because this is one of the more abused passages, I think, in the New Testament, quoting a passage from the Old Testament. We need to be clear about that. And I'm going to take a minute just to look at that in Matthew chapter 12. So Brent's making this point that whatever God's saying about desiring mercy and not sacrifice, He's not saying He doesn't care whether or not you transgress His law, and we shouldn't either care about whether His law is transgressed. That's not what He's saying. So in the context of Matthew 12, what's the deal? They were His disciples plucking grain and eating it on the Sabbath as they walked through the field. Is that how it starts out? Okay. And then the Jews objected to that because they're supposed to be working on the Sabbath day, right? That's what they said. And as part of His answer to that, Jesus quotes this passage. He says in Matthew 12 and verse 7, "If you have known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice." Here's where a lot of people quit reading. "You would not have condemned the guiltless." Had the disciples broken the law? Jesus says they're guiltless. He's not trying to justify guilt. He's declaring them guiltless. He doesn't have to forgive them of anything. They didn't break a law. Y'all got that? What a lot of people read this and they think Jesus is saying, "Oh, well, they defiled the Sabbath," and Jesus is saying, "Oh, that's okay sometimes." No, they didn't defile the Sabbath. What does Jesus say? They were guiltless. You don't condemn the guiltless. If, you know, that's injustice. That's what that is. That's what He's condemning. And backing up in that, He condemns their hypocrisy. What did David do one time in that context? He ate the showbread. Is Jesus necessarily condoning going in and eating the showbread? No. But you know what the Jews didn't do? Did they condemn David? No. What hypocrites. Hypocrisy. Here, they're not going to condemn David. That's his argument there. They don't condemn David. Jesus isn't justifying David necessarily, but He's saying, here's David. He did something everybody knows you can't do. And you don't say anything about that. And yet My disciples are not breaking a law, just walking through, picking up some grain and eating it. They're not breaking the law. They're guiltless. It's an important point. Well, we got about half as far as we were supposed to get, and that's on top of getting only a third as far as we were supposed to get in the last class. So we are behind, is what we are. But I want you to keep on looking. We'll quickly finish up chapter 6 and maybe cover 7, 8, and possibly 9 Wednesday night. That is, yes, that is ambitious, but we are an ambitious people. Hosea, end of chapter 6, 7, 8, and maybe 9 Wednesday night. So study up on that. Thank you for your help and attention.